Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. Continuing in Pirkei Avos, where we take a look at a Mishnah that's frequently quoted. And the thing about, well, Torah in general is Torah, of course, is timeless. It applies in all times, in all places, and any area of Torah can give us insight about the different areas in life. But particularly with looking at different parts of Pirkei Avos for the last couple of weeks, it really directly speaks to the questions that we deal with nowadays, different trends in society. It really speaks directly to that. And you don't need me to say that if we followed its advice, I think we'd be a lot better off. And one area that Pirkei Avos gives us guidance on is in the area of argument, the area of machlokes. And it's relevant and it's worth looking into, because I think in the last couple of years, as a society, with all of the ways that we were able to communicate, we become very argumentative. And argument has become, not only an exchange of ideas, or maybe not even primarily an exchange of ideas, but sometimes or frequently very bitter, very personal, very demonizing. And the Torah, through the teachings of our sages, give us some guidelines for arguments. They don't say not to argue at all. The argument definitely has its place. At the same time, they caution us about the damage that argument can cause. So there, I put the source in the chat. I'll copy it again, and then I'll also share the screen. So in Pirkei Avos, we're given examples of an argument that the Mishnah terms it, that's l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven, and arguments that are not l'shem shamayim. And we're told an argument that's l'shem shamayim is sofa litkayim, that in the end will endure, and one that's not l'shem shamayim will not endure in the end. So the Mishnah says, kol machlokas shehi l'shem shamayim, any machlokas is for the sake of heaven, sofa litkayim, that in the end will endure. V'she'eino l'shem shamayim ain't sofa l'skayim. And that's not l'shem shamayim for the sake of heaven, will not endure in the end. So what's an example of each category? Ezei machlokas shehi l'shem shamayim. Zu machlokas hilel v'shamay. The arguments between Hillel and Shammai, the great sages themselves, and according to many interpretation, also Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, the academies that follow their teachings. V'she'eino l'shem shamayim, and a machlokas that's not l'shem shamayim, zu machlokas Korach v'chol adaso, the argument of Korach and his assembly. So you take a look at the Mishnah. The wording is interesting, and it's not completely apparent what it means. So I want to solicit some of your feedback to see what on the surface you think the Mishnah is saying. So one, we have a couple of statements. One is l'shem shamayim. What does it mean to be l'shem shamayim? Literally, the translation of the word is for the sake or for the name of heaven or in heaven's name. So what does that mean? What's a machlokas? It's l'shem shamayim. What's a machlokas? That's not l'shem shamayim.
I think l'shem shamayim is about, like, say, Torah.
So you're saying as if the like subject is Torah, then it's l'shem shamayim?
An example of the Hillel and Shammai, but it's done respectfully.
So you're saying it has to be on a substantive topic, and it has to be carried out respectfully?
Yeah.
And sounds reasonable to me. Anyone else?
It's also a matter of interpretation of law, interpretation of a Torah between Hillel and Shammai, and all they're doing is just providing their viewpoints on that interpretation. So neither is necessarily, neither is right and neither is wrong.
So we'll get to that. We'll see if one is right and one is wrong. Generally, when people argue, so they generally assume that they're right. You know, if they didn't think that they were right, they didn't think they were wrong sometimes. But that's something we'll have to take a look at, is in an argument, is there always right and wrong? So that's one aspect. But I think what's coming out of here is that it has to be a substantive issue, and it has to be done in a respectful manner. Now, what's a little bit more tricky to completely understand on the surface is, what does it mean? It says, sofo lehitkayim, that in the end it will endure, that in machlokes l'shem shamayim will endure, or will stand in the end, and that's she'enu l'shem shamayim, that's not l'shem shamayim, ain't sofa lehitkayim, that in the end it will not endure, it will not stand. What does that mean?
Rabbi, can I just ask a quick question? I think there's some semantics here, because the word machlokas is not really arguments, it's differences of opinion. So it could be discussion, which doesn't necessarily, argument has a negative connotation to it. When you say differences of opinion and discussion, that doesn't have a negative connotation to it. And isn't that what Beit Chil and Beit Shammai were? They weren't arguing with each other. They were giving differences of opinions.
Well, I think they were arguing. I mean, there were different opinions, but Beit Hillel was saying that the law is like me, and Beit Shammai is saying that the law is like me, and would bring proofs to strengthen their position and to disprove the other position. So I think that they were definitely arguing. One was definitely saying that they weren't just, you know, I do what I do, you do what you do, that they were asserting that they were correct.
But it doesn't end up in a fist fight.
Right, so it's the manner in which it's done. That's definitely an aspect of it. So when we say sofo litkayem, that in the end it will endure, what does that mean?
You know, I'm thinking about, they have this thing, the rule of five or the rule of 10. Will it matter in 5 minutes? Will it matter in 5 hours? Will it matter in 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months, 5 years? So I think that materialistic arguments tend to be short-lived.
So you're saying the importance of the argument will be appreciated, let's say, after 5 years, meaning it will be an issue that people will recognize as substantive, and the ideas that were presented in the argument will be worthy of analysis.
Yeah.
In other words, the issues are important. So these are all, well, these are all interpretations that are provided, and then they give us an insight into what arguing is about, or what arguing should be, and of course what to avoid when arguing or even disagreeing. So the Mishnah doesn't say explicitly whether argument is positive or not. And you know, we have this term sofo litkayem, that in the end it will endure. So maybe, as Rhonda says, that there's an element of importance in it, but it doesn't tell us necessarily whether it's good, even the machlokas between Hillel and Shammai. But
can I offer something else?
Sure.
First of all, I think it's important to notice that in the two halves of the beginning of the Mishnah, the word machloket is not repeated in the second half. Simply says, Yisha'ina, doesn't repeat the word machloket. And I think the importance is this. I think that the word machloket, although we use it as argument, there is a beautiful meaning within it, which is the word chelek. So
right.
The disputants each acknowledge that they only have part of the puzzle. And so what it means, lehit kayem, means that because you have, in the simplest case, two people who each have half, it's guaranteed that the process will lead to a completion.
Wow, excellent.
Go ahead.
No, that's a very good point, that the pieces of the argument, the chalakim, will remain, will be important, and that there will be what to learn from both sides. And then that's how the Mishnah is interpreted. And it's generally understood that there are benefits to machloket, whether called disagreement or argument. So what do you say are the benefits to machloket? So
hashing out the details.
Hashing out the details, analysis. And there's the analysis. Also, what Moish just alluded to is there will be in both sides, in an argument, how it should be argued, in a way that's l'shem shemayim, there will be certainly what to learn from both sides, but maybe even truth on both sides. Maybe they won't be mutually exclusive. So this is as far as the benefit of machlokes. So number one, the Bartanura explains in source number two, is that what does it mean, sofo lehit kayim, that in the end it will endure? So it means one, he's at a literal level, the disputants and their students, so their descendants will be around, meaning they won't meet a fate like Korach and his followers. Korach and his followers were swallowed up, and there was really nothing left of the group that argued. So they won't meet this terrible fate, an argument that is for the sake of heaven. Even if one is right and one is wrong, we're told that they're not going to, you know, be punished. They're not going to have the type of fate that Korach and his followers did. So that's one, on a basic level, what it means, sofa litkayim. Not even the argument itself, just the disputants will be around, just like Hillel and Shammai and Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, that they were around. And also that if the aim of the argument is to arrive at truth, so then that will endure because from the dispute, the truth will be clarified. That by exchanging different ideas, so through that, as Moshe was saying, through these chalakim, these different parts of the discussion, the truth will be clarified. Either they'll realize that they together don't have the whole thing and will together come and clarify the issue, or even if they determine that one is right and one is in fact wrong, the process of discussing it, of pushback, will help clarify the truth. And if that's the case, then it will be enduring. Then it will be an argument that was important and that we look back on and we learn something from. So that's one aspect of it, is just that the disputants won't be harmed, they won't be punished, and also that the argument, the exchange of ideas and the pushback will help arrive at the truth. And the Meiri also expands on this idea. Number three, he said that in the debates of Hillel and Shammai, so one of them would render a decision, the other one will argue against it out of a desire to discover the truth and not in order to provoke or to wish to prevail over the other. Meaning, as we had mentioned before, that there's one, the substance of the argument, but also it's the manner of the argument and the intention of the argument. We're saying the intention here is not to win, not to assert power, but there is a collaborative effort to discern the truth. And that's why it's l'shem shemayim, that it's for the sake of heaven, for the sake of clarifying the Torah. And what does it mean when it says that it endured? That l'kein kaimu divrei hacholek, that the words of the one who disagreed will endure, because since they also contain truth. So it's not just the Bartanura that we saw. There could be slight differences between these points. One is that maybe in the end, one is right and one is wrong. But even from the discussion, they'll be able to clarify the issue. But ultimately, there's one outcome that's correct. And Meiri is saying that even the argument that's ultimately rejected, at least in practice, contains truth. And that truth, that information that's offered will be enduring, will be valuable even after the argument is over and even after the issue may have been decided according to the other opinion. And Leora gives an example of the value of having pushback, having one's assertions or first impressions being challenged, because in order to do that, you sharpen the understanding of the topic, and you have your clarity of the issue, and you're able to come to a decision that's more grounded than before the argument. And a little while back, when we were learning about different agadotas in the Talmud, so we looked at the story of the friendship of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Right, Reish Lakish was the bandit. Rabbi Yochanan saw him, wanted to bring him back, and they became brothers-in-law. But they also argued on many issues. And one day they were learning about when different knives and different weapons can acquire ritual impurity. And in that discussion, they disagree. And in the discussion, Rabbi Yochanan says to Reish Lakish, "Well, you know, because you know a bandit knows banditry." And Reish Lakish was very hurt by that. So it shows what happens, that even the manner of argument, you have to be very careful. And Reish Lakish was very hurt. And so then Reish Lakish was hurt, and Rabbi Yochanan was upset. So they sent someone else to go learn with him. They sent him this sharp student, Elazar ben Pedas. And he says, he's sharp. So he went down and he learned with Rabbi Yochanan. And every time Rabbi Yochanan would say something, Elazar would cite a supporting source. He'd say, "Oh, that's a good point. I have a source for you. The student was very sharp. He clearly knew all the sources and would support him whenever Rabbi Yochanan made an assertion." And Rabbi Yochanan says, "Well, you're nothing like Reish Lakish. When I would say something, Reish Lakish would ask me 24 questions, and then I would respond with 24 answers. And as a result, learning increased."
He didn't need
when I was challenged. Then we gained more. Then I gained more clarity of the issue. He would challenge me 24 challenges. I would be able to answer his questions. And for there, we were able to clarify the issue more. You just tell me that everything I say is right. So how do I know if I say good ideas if I don't have this pushback? So he walked. He tore his garment and he wept. And he realized what he lost without having his chavrusa who would challenge him on everything. I think we see two things from here. We see one, the necessity of having pushback and having our ideas challenged. We're not able to defend the ideas. It says that Reish Lakish would challenge him with 24 questions. He would be able to respond. But in order to respond, you have to be able to defend an idea. If you just have an idea, it may be correct, but if you're not able to defend it, you're not able to properly articulate it, so then you may not realize that there's some errors in it. They see that there's essential to have pushback, and Rabbi Yochanan realize what he was missing when Reish Lakish was gone. But also it shows you how do they get into this situation. Is Rabbi Yochanan insulted Reish Lakish in the course of their argument? They were arguing about a halakhic issue, and Rabbi Yochanan made a comment to Reish Lakish. He gave him a little bit of a jab, and you see how hurtful it was. He reminded him of a time in his life when his behavior was less noble. And we see the harm that can have. So it shows, even in the context of learning, where argument is productive, you have to be very, very careful, because people have different levels of sensitivity, people have different senses of humor. And you can say something to someone and maybe not even mean any harm, But you can hurt them, and then that has terrible consequences. At the same time, Yochanan realized that if his ideas weren't challenged, then the outcome of the learning wouldn't be as sharp.
Rabbi.
Yep.
Right at the beginning, we talk about l'shem shemayim.
Right.
machloket l'shem shemayim, and would that necessarily mean that the people arguing are very learned people, okay, arguing over a certain issue? Can we extrapolate from that that Korach was also a very learned person or not?
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, Korach was a very learned person. And if we take a look at some of his arguments, they may have had some validity to them. So that's what we'll have to see. What was the difference with Korach? Korach was learned, and he was challenging, according to Midrashim, he was challenging Moshe about halachic issues. We'll see what was really the problem. But right, Korach, it is understood that Korach was very learned. Nevertheless, it wasn't L'shem Shemayim, and we'll see why in a little bit. So with some of these explanations, we say a makhlok is L'shem Shemayim, and sofer l'tkayim, that it will endure. So we said either that through the discussion, the truth will be clarified, or even beyond that, that there's truth to both sides. There's even truth in an opinion that's rejected. So now the question is, you know, how does that really work? One person says it's kosher, one person says it's not. So is it kosher or is it not kosher? Right? What is it? Someone says something is permitted, someone says it's forbidden. Can they both be true?
If there's doubt, you go with it's not permitted.
Well, it depends. We have different rules when there's doubt. When there's doubt about a Torah issue, when there's doubt about a rabbinic issue. But okay, that's if there's a doubt, and you know, we have to do something. But fundamentally, one person says forbidden, one person says permitted. Can they both be true?
Yes.
Yes. How?
Could be under different circumstances, at different times, in different locations.
Okay, so that could be, is that there are, in addition, when determining halacha, so you look at what the principles are and when you apply them to different scenarios. So there is a discussion about what if ideas are mutually exclusive. So can you, you know, let's say, someone says one says a particular, you know, type of food is kosher, one person says it's not. Let's just say they say objectively it's not. One thing is allowed on Shabbos, one thing isn't. So can they both be correct? So the Gemara in Irvin quotes this as a source for Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, that these and those are the words of the living God. So how does that work? So it's for 3 years, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel argued. And each one says the halacha is like me. The other one says the halacha is like me. Yatza baskol the amra, and a baskol, a heavenly voice came out and said, "Elo ve'elo divrei Elokim chayim." These and those are the words of the living God. V'halacha geveis hillel, but the halacha is like Beis Hillel. So you say why? So why was the halacha like Beis Hillel? So it said that Beis Hillel in general were agreeable and forbearing, and also that when they would teach their opinions, when they would lecture about the issue, they would quote the opinions of Beis Shammai prior to their own. So they had a humility and they had a extra degree of intellectual honesty. But the statement is a little bit puzzling. This has become so frequently cited that we just say elav elav divrei Elokim chayim, right? These and those. But what does that really mean? Again, once is permitted, once is forbidden. Let's say same situation, not even, okay, we have different situations. Same situation, one says it's forbidden, one says it's permitted. How can they both be correct? Now, all we're told here is, so how do we determine which opinion to follow? Okay, so we say, it almost sounds arbitrary. Beis Hillel maybe had this quality about them, so we follow them. But does it mean Beis Hillel is correct? Or means they're both correct? How does that work? How do you understand that?
Well, Shammai was seeking the truth too.
Right. And it doesn't say that Shammai was wrong.
Right. So he may have been stricter than Hillel, and normally he was. And the rabbis, or God himself in this case, rules in favor of the less strict approach.
Right. So this issue was actually the discussion, actually more of a philosophical issue, discussion of, you know, was it, is it would it be better that man hadn't been created, or if it's created, let him examine his his deeds. So some might say maybe better not created. Maybe it's, you know, it's either, could be either one or the other. Or let's say in regarding Hanukkah candles. So the basic requirement is to light one candle, but you're doing it in the optimal way. So Beis Shammai says light eight and then go down to one. Beis Hillel says light one and then go up to eight. So, you know, which one is it? It's not necessarily stringency or leniency. It's just a different, it's a different opinion. So which is correct? And even beyond, you know, Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, there are many other sages that argue. There are many different halachic opinions throughout the ages. So how do we determine one if one's right and one's wrong, if they're mutually exclusive? So there are a couple of different approaches. One is that when Hashem gave us the Torah, so what did he give us? Maybe he didn't, according to the Ritva, he says many of the French rabbis had this approach. How can they both be words of the living of God when this one permits and this one prohibits? So he says that when Moshe went up to receive the Torah, so what did Hashem give him? He gave him for each issue, it says 49 bases for prohibiting and 49 bases for permitting. Okay, so what are you supposed to do? So Hashem told Moshe that, you know, Moshe said to Hashem, what am I supposed to do? So he says that, and now it's given over to the scholars of each generation, that they use the raw information. They have the tools at their disposal, and each issue has different bases to permit and different bases to prohibit. So as long as you use the tools at your disposal within the confines of how to interpret the Torah, within the information that we have, so it could be that one could determine it's prohibited and one could determine it's permitted. But they can both be true because it's like a, you know, maybe different ways to do a puzzle, or maybe, or you're given, you know, the raw ingredients that you may be able to produce the different outcomes. It can't be, you know, they also say Shivim Panim LaTorah, there are 70 interpretations of the Torah. So here, okay, it can't be, you know, 49, it can't be number 50. The point is it can't be without, you know, if there's a verse in the Torah that contradicts the ruling, or if there's an explicit Mishnah, then you can't go against that. But within something that may be ambiguous, so you have to look at the issue and analyze it. And there could actually be different conclusions that are both correct, you know, that are both consistent with what Hashem gave Moshe at Har Sinai. Now, what we see from the Gemara above with Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai is ultimately we need to know what to do. So we have certain ways that we determine which opinion to go like. Generally, we go like the majority. We have this case where it actually says that in general, we follow one opinion over the other. But that could be that according to the Ritva, and he quotes the French rabbis, that it could be that they're actually both true. Others don't go as far, but say that more take the approach that in the end, one is right and one is wrong. But by analyzing the issues and by taking into account the opposing view, you're able to clarify the idea in a fuller way. So the Chidah, Chaim Yosef David Azulai, in his commentary, says that when he says Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim, it doesn't mean that both of them are true. He doesn't go as far as the Ritva. But he says, since light is only noticeable against darkness, the opposing idea will help to understand the true idea better. Right? Sometimes you have to look at something. Sometimes you have to see the opposing arguments, and then you can help clarify the correct opinion. And it's also that's why it's called Divrei Elokim Chaim. He says not because the opinion that's rejected is correct. He assumes that in the end it's incorrect. But it's called Divrei Elokim Chaim because it serves a function. It serves a function of clarifying the idea that is correct. So again, you have the Ritva that says that It could be that multiple things are correct because we were given basically the raw ingredients to work with. The Chidon and others like him say that no, one is in fact right, one is in fact wrong. But the reason why the incorrect opinion is called Divrei Elokim Chayim is because it serves a function to help clarify the accepted opinion.
Rabbi?
Yep.
What about the example of putting on tefillin and wrapping it one way or the other way? How does that fit into anything here?
Right. So the direction of wrapping is more of a matter of custom. I don't think anyone who said that there's an opinion that says whether you wrap inwards or outwards, that if you do it in the opposite way, you wouldn't fulfill the mitzvah. With tefillin, there are, however, questions which could make it could affect whether you fulfill the mitzvah or not, about the order of the parshios, different passages in the Torah that are in tefillin, what order and what compartment are you supposed to place them? So there are more than just Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, but those are two ways that tefillin are made. And the accepted opinion is like Rashi. That's the basic halacha opinion of Rabbeinu Tam. There's the parshios, the different passages in different compartments. So there are people who do it in deference to the opinion. But that's an example where if this matter weren't decided, so according to one, if you followed one opinion, so then you would assume you wouldn't fulfill the mitzvah according to the other opinion. So which is right and which is wrong? So according to the Ritva, you'd probably say that, okay, both Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam were using the tools that they had that were given to Moshe at Sinai and came to different conclusions. According to the Chidon, number 7, may have said that one is right and one is wrong. Presumably we conclude like Rashi, and they say that Rashi's right. But Rabbeinu Tam in that discussion could help us clarify the issue. But Charlie, as far as the point is, that's correct. There could be areas of halacha that you would say maybe you wouldn't fulfill the mitzvah according to the other opinion. So what do you say? Do you say that the opinion that we don't follow is incorrect, but has what to offer as far as increasing our understanding of the issue, which is why I call it Divrei Elokim Chayim, or that it's in fact an alternative outcome of the tools that we were given at Sinai. Sorry, Moshe, you were going to say something?
I just want to give you a lot more interesting example. When you were not yet born, but in the 1940s, I think was when open heart surgery came into the States and Canada, and none of the rabbis would permit that to happen. But after about a decade and people were surviving open heart surgery, then all the rabbis, well, I should say all, but most of them. And so there you have it. There are principles to be learned. And the ones who said no were right at the beginning because the matter was how early can you accept this sort of very, very drastic surgery in that time? Or everybody was right later on because it had proven itself. So it's a matter of what's the process? What is the process?
Right.
In that case.
So you're just saying the opinion that was right. In general, with heart surgery or organ donation or end of life, you know, those are very, very serious issues. And according to some,
Rabbi,
might say that the other opinion is murder. You take someone if you hold that you don't say you need cessation of heart function and someone pulls the plug on, let's say, brainstem death. So really hold that opinion. So you say the other opinion is murder, where there's people who would say, you know, that the brainstem death is death and you should do it because then you can donate organs. So these are real issues. So maybe you could say that both opinions are using the tools at their disposal and they're in a sense true, even though they, according to one opinion, according to the other opinion, they're incorrect, or that each helped clarify the other one. But that's something that's not completely decided yet. Charlie?
Yeah, I was just thinking about if people are arguing or discussing whether something is a mitzvah, you did it the right way, it's not a mitzvah, you did it the wrong way, and there's a machloket. But really, really, the bottom line is, what does God think?
So that's the point. Because let's say you file an opinion that's, let's just say, is not accepted. Or do we say that God said that the one is right and one is wrong? All right, that's the question. What does God think? Does God think that we're doing something wrong? Now, we also have a principle that we follow the majority, that God does, that he gives us a method of determining halacha or of deciding between two opinions. All right, that's fundamentally a good question. So what does Hashem think? As far as Hashem, is one right and is one wrong?
Is it really important? I mean, is it really, really important to know really what God thinks? Or
right, God tells us how to determine halakha. I mean, we have rules, like, for example, going after the majority, even though, like the Gemara in Bava Metzia, where there's a baskel that says the halakha is like Rebbe Lezer, but then the majority don't follow that. So we're told that we should follow the majority opinion. But that's an instruction of how to decide between two opinions. The Torah says Akrei Rav Lahatos, you should go after the majority. So we say if we do that, then we're doing the right thing. But we're saying fundamentally, are they both correct? Let's say one is rejected. So that's we're told it's Divrei Elokim Chayim, that's the word of the living God. But the question is, what does that mean? Maybe it means that it's both correct, or that even the rejected one helps clarify the opinion that ultimately is accepted. Another perspective is offered by Lubavitcher Rebbe that not every argument is there right or wrong, right? Some are, can be a matter of perspective. And what he says is actually probably more similar to what the Ritva says, is you have arguments between Hillel and Shammai, Beisel and Beis Shammai, in different areas of halakha. So he actually says that if you look at those different areas, you can see distinct perspectives and approaches of each one. So for example, on the first night of Hanukkah, if you want to do it in the optimal way, do you light 8 and then go down to 1, like Beis Shammai, or 1 and go up to 8? That's the reason for Beis Hillel, is you increase in holiness and don't decrease. Beis Shammai says it's based on the karbanos that are brought from each day of Sukkot, and then they go down. So Beis Hillel says you go up. Beis Shammai says you go from 8 to 1. The question is, what's considered the precise moment of the Exodus as far as when to say Hallel before partaking of the Karban Pesach? So is it the fifth of Nisan, or is it on midday the following day? So it says that it will affect when you recite Hallel. So he says that basically you could say that the perspective of each one in these cases, and he brings others, are a matter of perspective. Is the more basic definition of an object or phenomenon its potential or its actual state? So it says, for example, so what is freedom? The potential to act freely or the actual removal of all constraining and limiting elements? So what's the time to sleep? Is it when people are actually sleeping, or is it time that they engage in the activity that results in the state of sleep? Or is it because there he's referring to Kriya Shema at night? Beis Shammai says you actually have to say it lying down. Whereas Beis Hillel says, no, you say it at the time when people lie down. The menorah, do you say it? Do they reflect the number of days? They reflect the number of days embodied by a particular evening of Hanukkah. So if you count the days which that evening possesses in potential, or those which have actually been actualized. So there are two realities. There's the potential and the actual. So they're both correct. The question is, which are we supposed to utilize in practice? So he says that, what does it mean that these are both words of the living God? So it means that they're both true. They're both correct from different perspectives. There's the potential and then there's the actual. Beis Shammai is really more in the potential. And because Hillel is in the actual. So which are we supposed to use? So again, they're both correct. Meaning we say that, let's say Hanukkah. So you have the fourth night, you're going to light the same amount. But let's say the second night. So do you light two candles or you light six candles? So the question is, how are you supposed to approach it? Are you supposed to do it from the, based on the actual days that have passed, or based on the days that are going to come? So again, they're both can be correct. One is not wrong, but the question is, what do you actually do in practice? What are we supposed to emphasize? So I thought of an example that comes up as far as whether, you know, different perspectives, whether it's not always a case of true and false or right and wrong. Some cases are, but some cases both sides will probably admit that the other side isn't incorrect, but it's a matter of emphasis. I had several discussions. I got a master's in education and we discussed this. And actually one time I was interviewing for a position, I ended up not pursuing it, but even the panel of this for a teaching position, the panel of the three people who were interviewing me had actually different perspectives on this. And the question is, it's among, you know, Jewish educators in particular in the elementary and high school level. So which is more important? Which should be emphasized in a content, facts and skills, or a more of an emotional appreciation for Judaism? Now, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but students don't always love working on language skills and on memorizing information. So they may have less of an enjoyment. At the same time, maybe you have only do the things that the students particularly enjoy, but you may not be able to build the set of skills that you could be able to with an elementary and high school education. So different perspectives, which should you focus on? So it was a discussion, I remember in the graduate school class, it was a discussion. The people had strong positions. You say, if you don't, you know, what's the point of going to school for 12 years if you're not going to pick up any skills? And their point, if you're not going to like Judaism, so if you're not going to have as positive experience, so then it's all going to go in the garbage anyway. So different perspectives on this. Now in that, when I was interviewing for this position, there were three people on the administration who were interviewing me, and they actually said they had different perspectives on this. So I think each side will not, you know, will fully acknowledge what the other side is promoting is a value, that it's not wrong, right? That the side that more wants to emphasize skills, they'll still say, of course, you need to want to have a love of Judaism. The love of Judaism side will say, of course, we wanted to know some skills. Skills are important. The question is, as an elementary school, as a high school, what should we emphasize? So it's similar to this, that it's not arguing, it's some arguments. It's a matter of approach. It's a matter of emphasis. And there could be many considerations into what to emphasize, but it just illustrates that not all arguments are about right and wrong. And not in every argument does one necessarily think that the other side is wrong. But it's more a matter of what to focus on and what to emphasize. And it's how the Lubavitcher Rebbe explains in this Beis Hillel Beis Shammai. You got an approach, you focus on potential or do you focus on the actual? And at the end of the day, you know, we like to make jokes, Jews, you know, two Jews, three opinions, which is probably true. But at the end of the day, listen, we need to, you know, sometimes, let's say a school needs to have a policy, they need to have a curriculum. We need to know how many candles to light. So Irving Bunim in his commentary on Pirkei Avos says what we also see from this, when we said the Elo ve'elo divrei Elokim chayim, but the law goes like Beis Hillel, is sometimes we don't have to persist beyond a certain point in asserting our opinion. If a vote has been taken and a decision announced, so then sometimes it's proper to accept the majority view. Right? Sometimes one's argument and one's perspective may be correct, but you know, Beis Shammai didn't, we don't have a record of Beis Shammai arguing the point. They'd say, no, the halacha is like us. Seemingly they acknowledged it. So, you know, that's also a lesson. This is, even if both opinions are right, even your opinion has truth to it, but the halacha, or in some cases the policy, may be decided according to another perspective, so you don't always have to hold your ground. And then it's also something that's important to keep in mind when arguing. even if it's L'shem Shemayim, and even if you're correct. So now just getting back to when we say a machlokes that's a sofa litkayim, that will endure. So what exactly will endure? So Rabbeinu Yonah, in his commentary on Pirkei Avos, says, what will endure? The parties who are arguing will continue to argue. How do you like that? That if they're arguing for heaven's sake, so it means that their argument will endure. So today they'll endure as people who are as basically adversaries. Adversaries, maybe not personal, but adversaries in terms of ideas. They'll argue about, Rabbeinu Yonah says, that means they'll argue about one thing today, another tomorrow, and they'll keep on arguing.
No, because in the Talmud you have recorded the minority opinion.
Exactly. I'm glad you mentioned that. You have recorded the minority opinion. We're not just told that about the opinion that was ultimately even when the Gemara says, you know, Hilchasa, that halacha is like this, we still analyze the opinions that were not accepted. Again, either because they're actually true, you know, or because they certainly help us understand the issue. Absolutely. And we don't throw out opinions that maybe weren't accepted. And exactly, the Talmud always quotes opinions that aren't accepted. And it's Talmud Torah. You can analyze an opinion that's not accepted. So maybe say, is that a waste of time? No, it helps us understand the issue. And it's Divrei Elokim Chayim. So Rabbeinu Yonah says, what does it mean that their argument will endure? Meaning they'll argue. You know, it's like Yochanan and Reish Lakish, you know, until the end. But they argue about many, many things. And they'll keep on arguing. You know, and they'll like to argue with each other. Many times people who argue, they respect each other. You know, then they want to argue, but they want to engage in discussion. So if they argue L'shem Shemayim, for the sake of clarifying the issue, for the sake of understanding better, of not being personal, so then they'll argue with each other. Like in a basic level, if someone is insulting you personally, you may not want to argue with them. But if you know that someone always offers a thoughtful perspective on issues, even if you may disagree with them, so then you'll want to argue more. So that's the reward. That's what it means they'll endure forever. They'll continue arguing forever. And it says that increases your days, right? You want to stay young? What do? Have a good partner to argue with. That it keeps you young. And what about an argument that ain't so for least kayim, that in the end will not endure, like Korach and, well, says Korach and his congregation. So we never heard from Korach again, right? That was it. And Yaakov Emden, it says, Sobelet Kayim, Hamachlok is Atzma, that the actual topic, the actual case that you argued about will be studied, as you just said, with every page in the Talmud, right? We record the opinions that were not accepted, that if it's L'shem Shemayim, they'll be studied. And it's a Machlokes B'komo Medes La'olam, that the argument in its place will endure forever. Shekein niskarim ben nasim b'chol dor, and it'll be mentioned in every generation. And we won't forget about it, right? We won't in the Gemara, an opinion that's not accepted. It's printed. We have it. We'll study it in every generation. And he says shafilu b'misifta derekia pligiba. Even in the heavenly yeshiva, They'll argue about it. You have, you know, Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai, Rav Shmuel, Reish Lakish, Rabbi Yochanan. They're arguing about it up there. They're Divrei Elokim Chayim. They're enduring. They're opinions that are worthy of being analyzed even after the argument has been resolved. And also, as Moshe said before, that what exactly does the term Shamayim mean? So Irving Bunin points out that it means Eish comes from the words Eish Umayim, right? Fire and water. So out of those materials that with heaven was made. So opposing principles united to obey the will of the Almighty and form the permanent unalterable heavens. So do the conflicting views of Hillel and Shammai, Chassidim and Misnagdim ultimately merge and integrate for the lasting enrichment and continuation of Jewish religiosity. They all form that tapestry of of Torah understanding and of serving Hashem.
How is Shama from Esh? I can understand Mayim, fine. But the first part of the word is Shama.
So it's not, I think it's not strictly etymologically that way. I mean, it's more of a homiletic interpretation. You have, you know, letters that are shared, but right, it's not literally a composite of those two words. But there are allusions to this, and it shows that even opposite principles can come together to form a unit and enrich our service of Hashem. So what's a machlokas that's not l'shem shemayim? So as Charlie mentioned, as we pointed out, Korach was a big Torah scholar, right? And Korach was seemingly arguing things that were relevant to Torah, right? He said a house with that's full of svarim doesn't need a mezuzah, a garment that's all tcheles. Do you need to put tcheles on the tzitzis? So, okay, these are real questions. Why was it rejected? So it sounded pious, and he says that the entire congregation are holy, right? That's a pretty valid argument. But then you see, what did he say? So then he says, the implication was, why do we need Moshe and Aaron to tell us what to do? Right? He says, why do you exalt yourself above the rest of the people? Meaning then it became very quickly a personal attack. And that's when we see that it wasn't really l'shem shemayim. But here's another question is, let's take a look at the Mishnah. So these are supposed to contrast l'shem shemayim and not l'shem shemayim. So who is l'shem shemayim? Hillel and Shammai. Who is not l'shem shemayim? It says Korach v'kol adaso. Korach and all of his congregations. What should it say? If we want it to be consistent. What about Korach and Moshe? Korach and Moshe and Aaron? Why does it say? Why does it say Korach v'kol adaso? Korach and his assembly. Ostensibly, they weren't the ones arguing. So one, it would be not respectful to include Moshe and Aaron there because they weren't involved in a machlokas, not l'shem shemayim. But even more than that, quotes Reli Melech of Lezhinsk, who says that there is probably the case, or it was the case, it's based on a medrash that Rashi quotes, that there was infighting that what the Mishnah is referring to is not Korach's argument with Moshe and Aaron, but among Korach's followers. And he says that where a group attacks its teachers and leaders and claims it acts for the sake of heaven, which they did, we can find the truth by examining the group. If it's harmonious and its members are genuinely bound by unselfish friendship, we can accept that they meant their action for the sake of heaven. But, and listen to this, if apart from the controversy which unites them, they're divided, right? You have people, they all gather around one issue, but they're not such good friends. Then we have a clear indication that their action here is not for the sake of heaven. So therefore, the Mishnah lists only Korach and his assemblage, their proof that they cared nothing for heaven in this quarrel. There were 250 of them, and every single one of them wanted to become the Kohen Gadol. So Midrash quoted by Rashi. It wasn't just Korach. All of them wanted to also have the position that Aaron enjoyed. So the Mishnah is telling us that what's it contrasting Hillel and Shammai? Not with Korach and Moshe and Aaron, but Korach and his own followers, that they were fighting amongst themselves. And he said the answer to the Chasam Sofer is quite consistent. For Korach and his motley crew of followers were antagonists. They were antagonists among themselves. And it also gives an insight into sometimes the types of characters who engage in machlokas, that when they're not attacking other people, they're attacking themselves. So you want to have one indication whether it's the Shem Shemayim or not. Well, who are the people involved? Are they people who, if they weren't fighting with you, would be fighting with themselves? Or if they're people who generally are very peaceful and they're taking up one issue, so then maybe you have an indication that it's the Shem Shemayim. But if there are people who are fighting amongst themselves, so then you really have to question it. So it could be the Mishnah is actually speaking about contrasting Hillel and Shammai with Korach and his followers, the machlokes among them. And when we're arguing with Shem Shemayim, so it shouldn't be personal. And the Gemara says in Kiddushin, in source number 15, that if someone is a father and a son, or a Rebbe and his student are engaged in Torah, and in one gate they become enemies with each other. But it says they don't leave until they love each other. Right? They're enemies, they're yelling at each other, but then when they leave, then they love each other. That it's nothing personal. Not only that, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, one, didn't refrain from marrying between each other's families, but even more than that, I didn't copy the whole discussion, but even on issues that they disagreed, the Gemara in Yevamos notes that Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai disagreed about issues of lineage, whether it's Mamzerus or things dealing with Yibum, with levirate marriage. So there were serious differences of opinion as far as lineage. But nevertheless, they didn't refrain from marrying between the families. And they would, if one of the parties, if according to one of the parties, the marriage wasn't permitted, so they would, you know, they would let them know. They would, you know, be strict in areas that the other party was strict in, and out of deference for their opinion. So it also shows sometimes there are different people, different people, you know, friends, different people in a community who maybe have different practices. And the example of Beis Hillel Beis Shammai is, you know, someone has a different practice than you. One, it shouldn't stop you from being friends, but if you're able to accommodate them, so it's the proper thing to do. You know, sometimes we, you know, it could be a tendency to look down on people who maybe are less stringent, but I think there's also a tendency that if someone, let's say, is more stringent in an area, sometimes there's a little bit of resentment. Oh, who does he think he is? You know, he thinks he's so from. Okay, that's what Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai are telling us, that one, obviously be friends, it shouldn't be a barrier to being friends, but also, let's say you hold so that something is permitted. Maybe you don't think there's a reason for stringency, but someone is stringent about something. So if you can accommodate them, that's proper to do. And that's what Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai did. Now, all that being said, that machlok is the Shem Shemayim, where it's not done out of personal feelings, and it's for the purpose of clarifying the Torah, and actually has the effect of sharpening our understanding of the Torah, we nevertheless have to be very, very careful about machlokas, even what we may think is machlokas l'shem shemayim, because a lot of people think that they're l'shem shemayim, and sometimes it can be more difficult to honestly evaluate whether you are or not. Actually, the Tosfos Yom Tov on the Mishnah notes that it says Hillel and Shammai, and not Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. So he understands this as meaning the original Hillel and Shammai. But once we're talking about their students, they were still tzaddikim, but it wasn't that same level of purity that the original Hillel and Shammai argued with. And maybe then there was some personal feelings. Now, it's not the way many others read the Mishnah, but sometimes you do see that among the, you know, Gedolim, among the great ones, among the originals, there was respectful relationship between those who disagree, but sometimes either among the students who weren't as familiar with the different with the opposing party, or you have the gedolim, but you also have the ketanim, you have the, you know, the great ones, but then you have people who are more interested in arguing. So it doesn't always, you know, maintain the level of the Shem Shemayim that it was originally. So he says that's even this whole idea of machlokas the Shem Shemayim is very limited. It may even be limited to Hillel and Shammai themselves, and maybe not Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, the academies that follow their teachings. Again, those don't necessarily, read it that closely. But what about us? After learning about all of this, right? It seems like, you know, machlokas l'shem shemayim. It's it's a pretty good thing. There are definitely benefits of it. So Rabbi Cheska Landau, in his Noda Behuda, writing in the 1700s, so he says, you know what? We're not in our generation. We're not lacking from machlokas, and he says, Uvizmanenu lo shchiach machlokas l'shem shemayim. It's already about 300 years. He's saying in our times, not very common to find machlokas l'shem shemayim. He says, Vesatan merakid. And the satan is dancing at this. His son gets a lot of satisfaction when he sees people fighting. He says he basically writes an appeal for peace. So that's also something to consider. While we've learned about that there is such thing as a machlokas as the Shem Shemayim, that could be value in it, when it comes to put this in practice, we have to be very, very careful. Shouldn't assume without serious self-reflection that we are completely Shem Shemayim. We do oftentimes have personal feelings and personal interests that we may not even realize or may not admit. So we're going to argue. We have to be very, very careful. But just note that a phrase that people say when they're arguing, like, oh, it's not about, they don't care personally, but it's the principle that matter. And a lot of times when people say that, it's really not the principle that matter. So we have to be very, very careful. You know, because of the risks of machlokas, more times than not, it's probably wise to avoid. But there are situations where machlokas can be l'shem shemayim. And I think it's something that, especially in our world, with all of the means that people communicate and share ideas, we should focus on ideas. We should appreciate the fact that there are people with different opinions who have what to offer. We have what to learn from different opinions, whether they may be right or whether we in fact think that they're wrong. And through that, hopefully we as a community and hopefully as a broader society, but at least us as a community, can pay particular attention to how we discuss ideas, to how we regard other people's ideas. And through that, if there are causes for machlokas, there should be only the Shem Shemayim, but through that come to a better understanding of where other people are coming from and come to a better understanding of the Torah, all the while keeping shalom. And Chazal tell us that even if the Jewish people aren't perfect, but there's shalom between them, so then we'll be in good standing with Hashem. So we should always try to cultivate shalom, learn from other people's ideas, and cultivate an environment of respect and friendship.